everything that rises must digitally converge. The Electric Symposium is an inspired literary podcast for examining the borderlands of philosophy, consciousness, and culture. Here, academics, art, and esoterica converge. My name is Jeremy Johnson, and I am your host. In this episode, I am joined by J.F. Martel, filmmaker, author of Reclaiming Art in the Age of Artifice, and a contributing editor at Metapsychosis Journal. Also joining me for this inaugural conversation are fellow MetaSci editors Natalie Bance and Marco Morelli. This podcast was in development for some time. Initially, it started as a podcast pitch by J.F. Martel, but evolved into a full-fledged essay, now featured on MetaSci as an article and an ebook, and a Stranger Things mixtape, also now available on MetaSci, with this podcast included. Follow the link in the show notes, and thank you for listening. Here with J.F. Martel, Natalie Bance, Marco Morelli, and we are all MetaSci editors and writers. And gosh, we've had quite a few conversations already about this whole idea of the 80s life world, which we're going to get into, as well as a few other subjects that Stranger Things just kind of evokes philosophically, metaphysically, media studies, all sorts of interesting things generated from it. Maybe, JF, we can get into, first of all, a little bit of background behind what got you started down this thought path of writing the Stranger Things essay for MetaSci, sort of the initial idea. What was it about the show that really drew you to it, made you want to write about it? What captivated you about it?
So when I learned about the, I was working on a shoot in Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is, as you probably know, is actually, we were on the outskirts of Winnipeg, which is on the outskirts of Western civilization. So like we were really kind of isolated and doing this, this kind of 3 week long grueling documentary shoot. And at night I was staying in a small room in a student's residence at the University of Manitoba on the campus there. And it was more like a cell. It was literally like a little prison cell. And I would, and we'd all end up there late at night after these long days. And I started to watch Stranger Things because the editor of the show kind of told me about it and said, oh, it's amazing. It totally revives or resurrects the world of our childhood and all this stuff. So I started watching it and I got swallowed up. You know, it blew my mind because I was so isolated. I think it increased the nostalgia effect for me. I felt I was separated from my family and far from home. And just to watch that and to kind of sink back into that feeling of being a kid in that time, it really, really got me. So that's what initially, more than the science fiction aspects or the supernatural elements or whatever, or even the plot, it was just the world they built, you know, and that feeling and how close it resembled to my mind while I was watching it, how closely it evoked what it was like to be a kid back then. So that's how I started thinking about it. And then it just exploded into a bunch of different ideas. And eventually the essay came out of that. So.
Yeah. So you grew up in the 80s. You were born, what, around mid-70s or so?
77, yeah.
77, yeah. See, I was born in 87, so I miss the 80s mostly, but even I have kind of like the fumes of the 80s kind of coming into consciousness, my first memories in like, you know, 89, 90, and kind of remembering that analog world, and my own parents were slow to come to pick up on computers and the internet and that kind of thing. So even for me, the show, you're absolutely right, it had this meticulous dedication to recreating the kind of atmosphere and aesthetic and just sort of the sense of place that the 80s had. And I think all of us kind of have that feeling here too. I don't know, Marco, you wanted to chime in about this aspect of the life world of the 80s.
Well, I was born in 75, so I fully experienced, you know, the 80s in the same kind of period of time that these kids would have been experiencing it in the film. But I think my experience was a bit different. So for example, I grew up in New York and on Long Island. So I didn't quite have the open sense of like nature and the woods, you know, that you might bike through. And the culture around me was just different than is represented in the particular movie. However, in terms of the, so in other words, I don't necessarily like identify as much with the kids and with the town. It was kind of my ideal, you know, small town and a very mythic kind of place. Like, I don't know if places like that actually existed. I think it's just like an ideal that we have in our minds now and that seem as if they existed. And that's partly an effect of the movies and the media and the culture of that time. So like one of the things I think that I commented to JF about his essay, or one question I had about it, something that it just made, you know, brought into question in my mind, was whether or not the memory is a memory of the actuality or a memory of the media created virtuality of being alive at that time and the TV we watched and the movies that were around and so forth and so on. It definitely plays with your memory, and it definitely plays with this kind of inner child. I wasn't in as vulnerable a place as JF, I think, was when the movie came to you, right? Because you were kind of there at the edges, like where the real meets, you know, where we kind of meet the real. And I'm kind of here in the Matrix, and I'm watching this on Netflix in the midst of my life. And so I'm in a different state of mind as I'm interfacing with this film. And I watched the final episode today, and it was a strange thing because like I'm here in my studio and, the girls are inside and it's just my everyday life, and I'm logging on to Netflix and I'm like, this is very weird that I'm doing this for work. And there's something just totally disorienting about like having these, you know, like doing this podcast, right? And like preparing to do this podcast together. And at the same time, I'm, as sort of like a creative act, as an artistic act, and as like a, I don't know, like a, I don't know what it is exactly. It's like, what are we doing exactly? You know, talking about this film, like we're kind of reflecting on culture and we're doing this as a, I'm kind of going off right now. I'm sorry that I'm, you know, just kind of going down a path, but it kind of like threw a lot of things into question, and it caught me in a vulnerable place in a different way today. And that is like, not from the perspective of being a kid, but from the perspective of being a dad. And I tell you, like the last episode hit me like, I don't know, like just totally broke me open. Like I was like weeping and stuff watching this thing. Like I was really seriously, I want to get into this a little bit more, but I realize that I'm rambling. And so all I have to say is that, that on the one hand, it was just this kind of cultural object, this Netflix video that I was watching. And, you know, I was preparing to do a podcast, which is a kind of superficial thing in a certain sense. Right. And then on another level, the kind of like transmission or whatever, like was really kind of coming through more deeply through the TV, kind of caught up with me. And it sort of like reclaimed me from this embeddedness in the matrix of my life. For what that's worth. That's my experience.
Well, I'm probably the only 90s baby here and in most of our social circles, because I was born in 90. So I like was just missed the 80s, which was unfortunate because I grew up as a little kid, like really for some reason, just being like obsessed with the 80s. I don't know if I had like a past life in the 80s or something. And it was just like listening to Prince when I was like 7. That didn't see an aunt and Queen, you know, but I will say something about in terms of the idea of the small town and whether it exists and that sort of thing. That is such a, people who grew up in New York and on the coasts generally, and you live in Colorado now, so you know this to a certain extent, but the Midwest is very, I mean, there still are small towns in the Midwest, and especially in Indiana where this film is supposed to be set, like those towns are very real. They're still very small towns. Those connections between people still exist, not to the extent that they used to be, you know, back then, but they're still very much real. I know, cause my whole job was for a while was going to these small towns and like going to the, like their little fairs and their little small town fairs and stuff and having like a little booth set up for the company that I was working for. So I met a lot of these people, and I have to say, like, the representation of an Indiana town is very accurate in many ways, like that the people inside of it. One thing I have noticed about filmmaking, when it comes to Indiana and the Midwest, especially when filmmakers didn't necessarily grow up there, is that Indiana especially becomes like this placeholder for like anywhere in between the coasts. And this is very noticeable for Hoosiers, like Indiana people, especially because we'll be looking at scenes that are supposedly shot in Indiana. It's like, that looks nothing like Indiana. Those trees are not what the trees that grow in Indiana. There are not hills like that in Indiana. My dad grew up in Muncie, Indiana, and was just watching Close Encounters the other day and was just like, could not get over, like kept making comments about that. That's not Muncie. Muncie doesn't have those hills. And it's, I feel like Indiana has become this sort of mental projection of like average small town, normal life in America. And it's not average. It has its own particular identity. It has its own culture and that sort of thing. But filmmakers use Indiana as a way of like expressing the common denominator of America. And that's really what they were doing, I think, in Stranger Things, is trying to just have like a nondescript town, like could be anywhere kind of small town. And they did that with Muncie as well. And Muncie in particular has been known to be like people go there for statistics because it's literally the most average city in America, or it used to be. So it's weird being from Indiana and seeing this dynamic of Indiana being used as this general Midwest culture.
It wasn't actually filmed in Indiana, though. It was filmed in Georgia.
I know. You can tell. If you're from Indiana, you can tell that it was not filmed in Indiana because the trees aren't right. And there's just like a lot of different things. But I guess what I'm saying is I don't have a problem with Indiana being used this way. I just like to note that these Midwestern states are often used as like this kind of dream space of America, where it's like all of these different cultural elements of America coming together in like this soup, where no particular place is actually like that. But you have to put it somewhere. So they put it in Indiana because it's a flyover state and that sort of thing. But it also does allow for like this kind of spookiness to come out of it, because I think it is in the really average spaces. And Jer talks about this a lot, even in Florida with our strip malls and the uncanniness of something that is so average. You're almost expecting something to be an aberration because something is so normal and so controlled. You're expecting the universe or nature or whatever to just like jump out at you and just start fighting against it. And I think that is an element of Stranger Things, but I'll pass it off to whoever you want to speak.
Well, that's a great transition note, actually, because as you were mentioning that, Marco, you grew up on Long Island, like me, actually. I grew up a little bit further out on the island, just not much further, though. I think you were kind of close. But just it was a suburb. It wasn't a small town exactly. But growing up in the '80s and nineties and watching films like Steven Spielberg's E.T., Close Encounters, and these kinds of films that usually take place, I mean, the Hollywood film of the suburbs and something supernatural happening in the suburbs is a really interesting trope. And in some ways, I know that Stranger Things was kind of hearkening back to this idea of the sort of mundane, as Natalie was mentioning, mundane suburbs where everything has been paved and cleaned and maybe not always clean, but certainly kind of average, certainly kind of, you know, middle class, 9 to 5. And yet something strange is going on. Like they've built this suburban tract home above a Native American burial ground, like in Poltergeist, or these kinds of archetypes of suddenly some kind of supernatural force, something that's been buried, paved over, forgotten, or something transcendent and cosmic coming down from the stars, just interrupts the mundane lifestyle of the suburbs. So I thought it was interesting because A Stranger Things is kind of harkening back to this kind of interruption of a kind of controlled and paved over reality. But then it's also kind of reaching back to the time of the analog before digital culture and into almost a kind of romanticized version of the 80s, which themselves seem more, in retrospect perhaps, themselves seem a little bit more open and susceptible to the supernatural or to the strange, as we've been exploring in other threads. So I guess I'm kind of just like leaving this as a sort of an open inquiry here, but was there anything more special about the 80s? And why are we so obsessed with this kind of Spielbergian 80s suburb as sort of the direct path to something uncanny happening?
I think that there was something in a sense. I mean, I don't think we live in the same world now that we lived in then, you know, except that today we're mostly just staring into screens. we're not confronted as much with the analog reality of, you know, going out to have to do some shopping or stuff like that. I mean, of course we still do those things, but a lot of the what William James called the intolerable intervals have been removed from our lives. And those intolerable intervals of having to kind of confront nature in various ways. And I mean, I'm talking about nature in the broadest sense of the term, of like having to leave the house, you know, as those things become less necessary, you're less and less confronted with, you know, the elements, you know? So I think in a way, it's not so much that we've lost something, but that we found we're distracted as a culture. And I'm not saying people back then were wiser or more in tune, but I'm thinking their technologies weren't effective enough to distract them completely. So that's one of the kind of underlying arguments of the essay. And, you know, yeah, so.
But I would argue, though, that there was a distraction going on at that time as well, a profound distraction that's even like encapsulated in the movies or in the TV show. You know, I think, you know, it comes through in surreptitiously. It comes through in these figures of monsters and poltergeists and so forth. But I mean, what was actually going on in the 80s when I started kindergarten, was the year Ronald Reagan was elected president of the United States. And I remember learning the Pledge of Allegiance. I remember having his portrait in our classroom. Little did I know as a child growing up what was actually going on geopolitically, and the Iran-Contra deal, for example, the wars in Central America. My mother is from El Salvador, and I didn't even really understand what was happening there. I didn't understand the profound interconnections between American foreign policy, for example, and the, you know, incredible, the death being visited, you know, upon the terror really being visited upon the, you know, the people in Central America, or certainly, you know, in the Middle East, and, you know, all over the world. Like, that whole reality was outside of my perceptions of the world. And so it was a shell. Like, I felt my parents protected me from that. In one way, it was their love for me that, you know, didn't expose me to all those realities. But at the same time, like, the fact that, you know, we had developed this kind of alternative or this virtual universe, you know, where, you know, certain visions of reality were real. Like, for many people, Star Wars is more real than Nicaragua, right? But in fact, you know, Star Wars is a virtual creation. It was a media creation. It was a capital creation. And, you know, these forces kind of wove a fabric of illusion that, you know, that we lived in, and that became our lives. It really became, I won't say defined, but it informed, you know, our consciousness.
Can I interject there and just talk about that, like, that simulation thing you're talking about? Like, 'cause that's definitely an aspect of the story is like, I don't know how many, I mean, I know JF, I know that you've been a DM before and so have I, but like the Dungeons and Dragons is like how it starts out. So it's like this thing that's supposed to be a distraction, but somehow is also like a mirror for the things that these kids are actually experiencing. And in many ways, role-playing games is exactly that. It's a mirror for the kinds of struggles and ideas and problems you're trying to figure out in your day-to-day life. You kind of live yourself through this character. And also it's an encounter with the uncanny, because when you go in so deeply into role-playing, you get into this other world. You become absorbed in it much in the same way you do with reading, but maybe even more engaged because you have a direct impact on the story. You're not just a passive reader. And it's interesting that line of, going into this unknown, this dark space is the same as like this forest that's sitting on the edge of town with this monster inside of it, basically. And it's like a borderline between these two worlds, this forest, which is like archetypally is like the unknown. It's the unconscious. And that's played out also within role playing. If you want to jump in there.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. And I also agree with Marco. And I think that of course people in the 80s, they weren't living without illusions. I was talking about a much more immediate stratum of reality. The level where you're putting one foot in front of the other on the sidewalk, or actually crossing, going down a wooded lane, or riding your bike at night and you have to get home before it gets too dark. That's the level of reality I'm talking about. And then of course there's that other level, the societal kind of cultural level, which has always been a way to protect us from the real. It's always been its function. And so you could say, if we compare ourselves now to someone in the Middle Ages, for example, you can see like stark differences. Obviously, the people in the Middle Ages lived in a completely something that most people today would call a fictional way of seeing the world, a completely mythological, constructed fiction about the universe in which the earth is at the center and the celestial spheres orbit around it, propelled by a celestial music of some sort and all that stuff, and they lived in that world. But at the same time, on the day-to-day level, on the immediate level, they were very much connected to the earth and to seasons and cycles and harvests and with the dirt and the grit and literally the blood and guts of the world. I mean, it was a violent, impassioned period of time where, and there's a wisdom that comes from that type of connection too. So there are just two levels, the individual level of how you're interacting with matter, and then the more societal level, how you think about the world on a more abstract level, by abstract, I don't mean unreal. I just mean on a more thinking of how other people are living and what this means and morally or ethically thinking about the big picture. These two levels are both important, but I was really talking about the digital, I think, increased our awareness of the other, but decreased our awareness of our immediate material surroundings. I think that's what the effect is. So that distinction, I think, is important. So thanks for making that point.
And yeah, if I could also jump in there too, just with a few tracks of thought as we've been going along. It's interesting because, we mentioned that in the 80s, everyone was dealing with their own problems too. And in some sense, these kinds of films that came out in the 80s, as sort of movie magic, was a sort of a way to kind of transcend the mundane of that life world of being in the 80s, being an 11-year-old or a 10-year-old or an 8-year-old and growing up in the suburbs and watching Spielberg and suddenly getting perhaps one of their first transcendent or religious experiences with watching, Close Encounters of the Third Kind or even E.T. And there's a lot of sort of archetypal structures to these movies where, there's something strange at the edge of the forest. There's something coming down from the stars. There's something coming up from the underworld, even if it is science fiction. So in some ways, yes, it's true. And to this point about the digital world versus the sort of the analog world, and this kind of 80s movie phenomenon nostalgia going on right now, I've been kind of thinking along a similar track, as you mentioned, JF, in that I've been kind of wondering, and Stranger Things is just one great example of many recent examples, including reboots and remakes of all these 80s films, like Blade Runner, the sequels coming out, I think, in a year or two. The rise of these Philip K. Dick reboots, Total Recall remakes. And then, of course, video games are playing with this idea, too. But I've been kind of thinking of this as a sort of, I guess to kind of explain it, Marshall McLuhan, the media theorist, talked about this a lot. The sloughed-off medium becomes a work of art in the new medium. And it's interesting that as we're entering into the digital world, and it's pretty much pervasive and ubiquitous at this point, everything is a screen, everything's a smart device, and it's kind of inescapable, we're kind of reaching back to the last moment where we were still analog. And yeah, sure, we're having fever dreams of going into cyberspace, and there was so much anticipation in the 80s for the PC and everything. But like you mentioned in your essay, and as you're mentioning before, it was really that kind of borderland between digital and analog. And it's so interesting that as we're moving and becoming more entrenched in the digital world, we're reaching back more and more into the analog world and kind of creating an almost a root or a kind of anchor to kind of hold on to, you know, that other life world. It's almost as if a part of us doesn't want to let it go, and it's suddenly realizing, now that we're losing it, how important it is. And so we're kind of mythologizing it in all of our films, and we're attaching to it and trying to recreate it and simulate it as digital denizens would do, simulate it through, you know, CG effects to replicate, like the Stranger Things opening. And they showed you how they originally did it. They actually painstakingly looked at different, you know, title screens in the 80s and like The Thing, and how they had to like literally use paper and like burning through with light or whatever. You know, it was a very physical process, and now we're recreating that through CG. So there's a kind of interesting reaching back to the 80s life world and kind of making it almost a kind of mythological origin point where we've all kind of been born into or born from. So that's just sort of my thinking around this, that, you know, the 80s life world has now become a life of work of art in the digital cyber world where we're all living in now.
I don't know where to go with that. I think that's true. There's a whole market for nostalgia products, you know, old video games, for example. Like if you can get the original console and the original cartridges that went into it, it's like worth a lot of money now. Same kind of thing with baseball cards. I think there's a certain, I don't know what's getting me into this mood. I feel a little bit like Slavo, you know, Žižek kind of, I want to deconstruct this from a sort of cultural, you know, perspective and the workings of capital. But, you know, I'm just recognizing the fact that I'm totally in the target market for this show. And I'm so, you know, and almost like a bullseye, really, because not only did I have an 80s childhood, but I also now am a dad. And one of the key relationships in the story is a dad and his daughter, right? Or his daughter who has passed. And this is the case of Hooper, right? The sheriff of the town, whose like daughter in some sense is in the upside down. Like this is the lost. This is the thing that we've lost, right? He's overdetermined, right? But one aspect, I think, of his personality is that, you know, he's lost something that he's trying to retrieve or he's trying to reconnect with. And that other thing is in the upside down. And that upside down is sort of this sort of dimension of memory, you know, that we have, lost touch with, you know, and it's in the forest somewhere. It's, you know, in our subconscious, or however you want to look at it. And then it comes through, you know, it kind of reaches out, and we have to go into it, and we have to reconnect or reform a relationship with it. Maybe that's what you're pointing to, Jeremy, is that, you know, we've, in moving into digital and in, like, say, people of my generation, like in their 40s or 50s or late 30s, who are moving into a new phase of their life and whose real like coming of age is kind of defined by crossing this threshold from the analog to the digital. It kind of hits us on that level as well. And I was, you know, thinking about like the magic that that is kind of affecting on me, at the same time that I'm recognizing the fact that it's also an illusion, and it's also sort of this virtual creation, and I'm in a target market for a certain kind of demographic. And that's not to reduce the artistic act of the filmmakers in making this film, but it's just to recognize that it's also part of a digital capitalist kind of, you know, enterprise where I pay a subscription to Netflix and, you know, and then we kind of trade in this cultural discourse, and it all kind of feeds back into a tapestry of illusion. And that's simply what it is. It's my perspective on what it is. I mean, I'm not really judging that exactly. I hope I'm not. But it did some interesting things as I was watching it, because I kind of went meta at the same time that I was like being affected by it, like on this emotional level, because, you know, like I was saying before, you know, I identified with the dad just like I did in Interstellar, and this sort of reaching back in time and this like reconnecting with this, the dimension of your childhood, but then seeing that reflected even in your family now, like, you know, the fact that I have two daughters and, you know, they're kind of growing up in this new world, and they're forming memories, which one day is going to be, you know, are going to be coming back to them. So it's all kind of a mind fuck, actually.
So I hear you, Marco. It's funny you mentioned Slavoj Žižek, because Žižek is a huge part of his shtick is that he'll find truth in pop culture, right? That's what he does. He'll look at Alien 3, or he'll look at They Live, which is an awful film of the 80s, but brilliant on another level, you know. He'll look at these films and he'll find how it's the ideology itself, the ideological machine, is always expressing its shadow, always betraying itself through pop culture. If Stranger Things had been a film about a guy who, you know, gets rid of his digital stuff, lives analog, and finds happiness and love, then, you know, there'd be nothing strange about it, you know. But what makes it strange is that it didn't intend to do this. At least I don't think so. It just expresses it. And I think that I agree with you 100% that these works that we analyze, we watch, we consume are products of the capitalist machine we live in. But I think that the criticism should be about, you know, trying to, it's like Deleuze says, when Deleuze would write past philosophers, he said, my point is to take them from behind and make them birth monsters. that's what Deleuze
said. That's pretty amazing.
So this was in another era where you could get away with saying something like that. So in a sense, that if we engage in these things, it's always to try to make them give us more truth, or try to get underneath the surface narrative to get at what's being expressed underneath.
What do you think you're doing with your essay? Like, what was the role for this essay in your relationship to the show?
The essay, I think the show spoke to me on a certain level, and I felt the need to write about it. So,
well, I feel like you related to it. Like, you didn't take it from behind and make it birth monsters. I mean, you really danced with it in, I think, a very elegant way in the piece, you know. And you, in a sense, it really reframed the show, and it, I guess, delineated, you know, some of the truths that I think could be evoked. And I don't know if they're so much intended, or if they were the unintended effects of just the, you know, the magic of the filmmaking, quite apart from any sort of, you know, socioeconomic or ideological type of critiques. I mean, there was, an inherent, I think, message to it, or at least one that you were able to articulate through the piece. And it particularly had to do with this idea that reality is more analog than digital. and an argument that you're making via the show about the way that we live today or the way that we even relate to the real today. So, and this is part of a larger project that you have as well, right? I mean, this is continuous even with your book, Reclaiming Art. So, I mean, the fact that I've kind of got infected with this Zizekian kind of, you know, approach is interesting because that's not exactly the approach you take. I mean, you're taking quite a distinct approach in this particular piece.
Yes, it's true. It was fully consensual between
So let's kind of go into some more of the meat of this essay and just, you know, explain for our listeners, what do you mean by the fact that reality is analog and not digital? What does that really mean? Can you unpack it?
The essay uses digital analog and analog as metaphors to represent two ways of looking at the world, which the philosophers have been discussing for some time. So the digital relates to what you might call the conceptual perception of the world or the conceptual apprehension of the world. And the analog relates to what you might call the intuitive or the durational, if you're into Bergson, perception of the world. So Henri Bergson is probably a key thinker here for me, because Bergson's whole project was to show how the intellect always ends up cutting up the real into slices, fixed concepts, fixed slices, and then lures us into mistaking those slices, those pictures, for reality itself. So for example, you know, an easy example is clock time. It's 3 o'clock. In 3 minutes, such and such will happen, whatever. But Bergson says that time is fictional. It's completely in the mind. What really exists, he says, is what he calls durée or duration, which is just this kind of deeply subjective and yet not subjective as in being opposed to objective. It is objective in another sense, but this deeply experiential sense of becoming or change. And his quest was to develop concepts that allow us to get out of the conceptual and back into duration. It's very similar to what they do in Zen, you know, which is try to get out of the concept and into the actual moment. Or so that's the metaphor I use in the essay, digital versus analog, is that old dichotomy, but I'm trying to frame it in a way that relates societally to the moment we're living now, because my fear is that as we become more and more digital, we become more and more ensconced, more and more sunk into that conceptual notion of the real, and more divorced from a non-human, truly objective other, that I call in my writings, I call the real with capital R.
I kind of wonder, is there a, as we mentioned earlier about a shadow of an ideology present in our pop culture and in our media, I'm kind of wondering just about the emergence of Stranger Things and stories and films and media like Stranger Things are maybe implicitly describing this kind of yearning for this 80s life world to return to it as we're kind of slipping away from it and being pulled more into this digital ensconcement. But I kind of wonder if there's, I wouldn't want to call it a dialectic, but there does seem to be a kind of feedback loop where a digital platform like Netflix, and which apparently, if you look at some of the, Natalie and I were just checking out an article about how hard it was to get the Duffer Brothers to get this produced anywhere, and Netflix finally picked it up. All the TV stations didn't want it. But I kind of wonder if there's a particular relationship between this unconscious aspect of yearning for this durational life world, this kind of the real, like not wanting to let that go, and then the media that we're producing in the digital culture. I'm just kind of seeing this feedback loop where digital culture suddenly creates these portals of escape, like lines of flight out of it, where suddenly, you know, like these stories in the 80s where the suburbs suddenly become an escape into an encounter with the real and the uncanny. Is there something about digital culture which is always kind of producing its own monsters, its own kind of nemesis, and kind of creating these sort of escapes from the matrix, you know, to relate back to a very good movie metaphor?
I mean, in a sense, I mean, everything creates its opposite. So analog created digital and digital has analog. And I imagine that it'll just keep going rotating forward. I don't know if there's anything particularly unique about digital. It's just another iteration of this like endless cycle of, you know, the idea meeting itself and creating something new. But in terms of the idea of like encountering something, the analog world, I don't know. I mean, I'll have to think more about it, the idea that reality is analog. If reality contains digital within it, I mean, we've talked about this before, technology as an expression of nature, but there seems to be like the seeds of something digital going on within Stranger Things, just because what we've been talking about, there's this analog world and then there's this girl who's tapping into this space that's not really anywhere. It's like in the mind. And she's learning these secrets about the Russian government and everything. And in the show, it's like a psychic connection that they're trying to bring forth. And then there's also these like psychic projections that are going on in the role-playing, the game and everything. And then also there's like the ultimate, like, psychic realm of the deep dark woods and the monsters that come out of it. And then the only thing that can really defeat that monster is the girl that has this connection, the psychic connection with it. So I don't know, playing around with that theme.
I don't know. It's a very interesting question for me, especially because basically around 11 or 12, I started living in the digital world, in terms of, you know, the first time I've learned to write and listening to music. A lot of it was just kind of sifting through digital debris and like picking up artifacts from the past and life worlds from the past through MP3s and MP4s and, bits of text and data here and there. So it's an interesting existence being an intermediary being. On the one hand, certainly feeling like the real is more analog. And on the other hand, kind of encountering the analog through the digital. This is a sort of paradox Mobius strip going on here, which I find to be very interesting. That I kind of wonder what your point is, in terms of there being, you know, is the digital and the analog kind of, are they just always going to be doing this dance, the transcendent and the imminent, the arborescent and the rhizomatic, as Deleuze and Guattari talk about? I have no idea, but we're getting into some very interesting philosophical questions here. But I think it kind of touches this kind of inner dynamism in these creators and all of us who are so drawn to this show. And at the same time, you know, that generation of the 80s were the ones kind of having these transcendent digital yearnings and to escape into cyberspace. So we seem to have these things built into us, this kind of analog digital impulses. It's just interesting. What are your thoughts about that, JF and Marco?
Well, I want to get a little more background information. I have a sense for kind of, you just said that when you were 11 or 12, that's when you started getting online. So like, in terms of your own growing up, you know, from a boy to a man, most of your, well, let's say like, you know, your prepubescent years were analog, right? And then around like your teenage years were already digital. Whereas for me, I didn't really even get online until college. So it was really coming out of my teenage years. My teenage years were completely analog in the kind of sense that I think we're talking about here, like with cassette tapes and, you know, we had cable television, but it was, I guess that was even still analog in a certain sense. It wasn't digital. So there's a different almost like strata at which the digital becomes like embedded in our inner, even in our like neurological development or brain development. And I imagine Natalie, you know, or you're more of a digital native really than us. And I wonder if you don't even like have the taste exactly of what analog means in the way that JF is writing about it.
I think that's a really good point. I think it's actually maybe fruitful to have an intergenerational thing between Gen Xers and millennials, even though Jer technically is a millennial as well. When my father brought home the first personal computer for our household, I was about 6 or 7. So I did not grow up with it from like a baby, like the kids are now, but I definitely, as soon as I was gaining language skills, was when I was getting on the computer. And so in some ways, I talked about this to Jared the other night, it was like, as soon as I was coming into consciousness as a being, as like a separate, independent being, separate from my parents and that sort of thing, I was like getting absorbed into this computer that for me was like this endless space of like files to discover and things that were in, you know, Windows 95 already like came preloaded with Myst and everything, which by the way, being like a 6 or 7 year old or 8 year old or however old I was playing Myst was like being on an acid trip. It was like, what is happening? Cause there was nothing like that before. And it's, I think it has informed my worldview a little bit. I have this intimate relationship with the computer as like being part of like my initiatory experience as an individual that I feel is like, I was pretty much the first generation to do that. But I don't know what that means. Of course, when I was younger, I remember things being completely analog when I was like 4 or 5 before we got a computer at home. And I played a lot outside when I was a kid, like those kids like on their bikes riding around and being in nature and stuff. I was like in the creek every day. So I was not this kid that was like on computers all the time either. It was like this, it was like I would be in nature all the time and then I would come home and, you know, play some games on the computer. So it was like whereas now I feel like there's a lot, the computer has taken over a lot more. It was like this separate space you visited and you like, it was almost like a temple. You kind of like came, there was like a sacred space you got. And then that was the space that the internet was at. That was the space that the games were. It wasn't everywhere, like on your phones and on the, you know, the internet of things, the way that we have now. So there was this like holiness almost to the computer that I felt even as a small child that I feel like is just so integrated now into our lives. Little kids probably don't really feel that as much. So I think my experience of the internet and the computers was extremely, extremely brief, probably only like a few years where kids were having those experiences until it became so integrated. It wasn't like this separate spot. So I don't know. I feel like I'm not the best person to ask about being an internet native because it's not exactly.
You're still on the cusp.
Yeah. So it was like, I was on the cusp, but I was, like I was saying, I was also on the cusp of consciousness, of awareness when I was like 5 or 6. So it was like this really interesting alignment of where my consciousness was at and kind of where the internet was at as well. And it like made this perfect alchemy of like experience for me that I is still thinking of those years and thinking of the experiences I've had on Windows 95. I've never been able to get that magicalness and that sacredness of like being in that computer and like in the Windows encyclopedia and going through the little maze and answering questions and stuff. Some people might get that reference, but I've never had it again. Not really. It's just like, seems like more of a tool now or just an extension of life, but it doesn't have that specialness that it did. So it was like childhood. It was like the internet's childhood and my childhood aligned in this perfect moment.
I think there is an element of enchantment with the digital in its earlier years. And JF, you mentioned this in your essay, with regards to technosis, Eric Davis has an excellent book that goes into sort of the magic of the digital and electricity and the kind of uncanniness it seems to have. It seems like a living thing, and yet it isn't, even though it kind of acts like it does when we, you know, just the encounter with lightning is a kind of primordial thing. And then knowing there's someone, there's lightning traveling through our machines and animating them and making them sing and talk and mimic us through these digital zeros and ones. It's kind of, there is a strange uncanniness to it. Kind of just like, almost like watching, like a golem come to life. It's made out of clay or mud or stone, and yet it has the semblance of a person. And in some ways, like we have our technology, it's this unliving thing, which is so lifelike or so imitating life. And in some ways, not. It's going in new directions. So, you know, the portals to the uncanny certainly do seem to continue into the digital, but I think something that we're all feeling now, and a testament to why Stranger Things is such an attractive, even before we go into the story, just the life world, the aesthetics, the recapturing of the 80s. The reason why it's so captivating, I think, is because we're sort of losing, as Natalie mentioned, this kind of developmental phase of digital culture. And we're kind of going into its ubiquity where it's no longer enchanting. And now it's kind of, it almost feels like we want to get out and want to get away. So if you look at sort of certain Tumblr blogs, there's not only 80s nostalgia, there's like Windows 95 nostalgia. And there'll be strange, weird apps you can do and load up on your computer where Windows 95 will be running on your browser, which is strange to think of now. You can open a tab and run Windows 95 on your browser. And then they have these uncanny Windows 95s where it opens up strange portals and weird music plays. And it just feels like some kind of acid trip from the 90s. But I think all of these things are kind of meant to kind of reach back. They're reaching for something that I think people are missing. And the reason why we're creating these things is because some part of us wants that back or is trying to make sure we don't lose that as we go forward into.
And what exactly do you think we're losing? Like, what is it that's being lost specifically to you?
Does anyone else want to try to tackle that?
I really want to know your answer. Okay. First, we can jump into other people.
All right.
Like, I want to know what you meant by
that. I think I think JF put it very well earlier about duration and that kind of durational time of being in the world and just sort of the uncanniness of life in the world and just being in the world itself. And we don't really pay attention to that anymore. And our media comes back and reminds us of it, but it's almost like a projection of the thing we're avoiding. So to me anyway, it's just sort of an enchantment with the world, a connection with the world as a living thing, and not to kind of bring a separate train of thought, but it's related to something we've been doing on Metasite. Colin Wilson's biography, Gary Lachman did an essay for us and an excerpt. Basically this idea that Gurdjieff used a lot, which is the robot, where life kind of loses its mana, it loses its magic, it loses its vitality, and we kind of roboticize ourselves. I think we're kind of as moderns and as hyper moderns, as super post modern virtual people, we're always in danger of automating everything. And I think a part of us is just reaching out to kind of connect with some kind of spiritual dimension, some enchanted dimension of the world. And so it was more porous in the early days of the internet and in the 80s. But as we go on, I think we're trying to figure out how to keep recreating that because it's a part of who we are as human beings.
So you feel like Windows 95 then was more of this porous kind of operating system that didn't, like, what I'm trying to
think. I mean, back in the 90s. Okay,
let's just say how bizarre it is that your childhood nostalgia is for Windows 95.
So I did also, like, I did have computers that, like, didn't run, like, operating systems that just had the black screen with, like, the green. Like, I did grow up with that as well, but, like, in school and that sort of thing. But the computer that my dad brought home the first time was Windows 95. So I do have experiences of both of those computers. But I want to know why you think Windows 95, like why you think there's a nostalgia for Windows 95. If you people are trying to reach back to analog, why would they be nostalgic about like the beginning of digital then? Why would that be so interesting? And let's let JF answer.
Yeah.
Well, I think that it's precisely they're nostalgic for that time when it was still in its infancy. So there's something innocent about it, but you're also connecting to what you were living when you were using Windows 95, which was a different world, a world where it wasn't as ubiquitous. So that's one possible defense of Jeremy's position.
One quick note about that too. I think the physicalness of the computer itself, the mechanical keyboard, the heftiness of the monitor, the kind of clunkiness of everything, and then the sort of novelty of it lended itself, I think, to some of the enthusiasm in the 90s about being in the World Wide Web and these kinds of things that were so novel and strange. They were more imagination than they were technology back then. And then perhaps that's what I'm getting at here, that there was an imaginative quality to the earlier technologies where it was sort of a 70-30 thing. It was 30% technology, and the rest we filled in the blanks. We projected the infinite possibilities. VR is a perfect example of in the 90s of how we were thinking it was going to be this thing, and it really wasn't. But there was so much, there was an event horizon of hype and imagination that we chased. And I think in the 80s definitely had that as well, for the internet and for just computers in general.
So I think that probably what you're pointing to is that you still had to connect to the internet at that time. And it usually happened through this one particular portal, this temple, as Natalie put it. I used to have a modem. It was dial up, and you had to ring in to your internet service provider. And it would make that funny, you know, crazy sound. And that's when you would be online. Online was a step removed because you had to go through this whole protocol to even access it. And something has changed relatively recently, actually. I mean, it's like the last, really since like the iPhone, that there's no longer any connection act. Like we are constantly connected, at least those of us, you know, in this particular society. And now that we've like arrived in the land of our fantasies, we're sort of like disappointed, I think. I mean, it's, you know, like the hype has come and gone, and we realize that what we were fantasizing about in this world of infinite possibilities and infinite connectivity and so forth, it is fantastic, but it's like intellectually fantastic. Like the original like childhood thrill of it, it doesn't seem to be there anymore. And I think there is a generational difference too in like how we think about our relationship to our devices. Like, I don't think I hear so many younger people, like more closer to the digital natives side, really stressing about the fact that like they're so distracted all the time and they're like lost their connection to the analog. I wonder, this may be conjecture at this point, but I wonder if there is really even a concrete sense for what it would mean not to be connected all the time for many people. And so like the sense that we've lost something, that we've lost that sense of duration, that sense of real time, just doesn't even exist. Like people like Andrew Sullivan, who just wrote an essay about this, because, you know, he was like a hardcore blogger, like online 16 hours a day or whatever, and basically crashed, right? But he's a bit older. So he had a prior groundedness or rootedness in this analog reality. And then he went, you know, full steam into the digital, crashed and burned there, and now is like trying to reconnect. And I think like that's what a lot of people are doing. And has to, you know, it invokes this sense of nostalgia and invokes this sense of, you know, like a return. But what was really lost, that's, I think, the, you know, that's like the theme of this show on one level. And I think that's what you are really talking about, JF. And I mean, you're kind of arguing that what's really lost is the real itself, which, you know, that's quite a claim.
I don't say, no, I don't claim that we've lost it. I claim that we distract ourselves from it. And so, and if that's if that were the case, then there's no, it's not a question of retrieving some cultural, like some lost cultural artifact that we have to revive in this kind of a kitschy romantic way, but of connecting ourselves to reality, which we try to distract ourselves from constantly. And reality is our bodies, you know, our bodies remain analog devices, you know, they remain subject to all the intolerable intervals of each process that they have to perform. All the organs connect in the most primitive fashion. Of course, the body is also animated by all kinds of electronic, essentially electronic circuits of all sorts and all that stuff too. But the point is that I wanted to read this passage from, this is a great book by Jonathan Crary. It's called 24/7, published by Verso. It's an amazing meditation. And he's older than Marco and I are. So he's even, so maybe this just plays to what Marco is saying. But he writes about this 24/7 world that we've constructed and that we live in, and that it's square for him. It's clearly in the interests of power to trap us in this world of constant time management, control, and all that stuff. So then at one point he writes, there are, of course, numerous interruptions of the 24/7 seizure of attentiveness, beginning with television, but especially in the last two decades. One became familiar with the transitional moments when one shuts off an apparatus after having been immersed in any televisual or digital ambiance for an extended period. There is inevitably a brief interval before the world fully recomposes itself into its unthought and unseen familiarity. It is an instant of disorientation when one's immediate surroundings, for example, a room and its contents, seem both vague and oppressive in their time-worn materiality. Their heaviness, their vulnerability to dilapidation, but also their inflexible resistance to being clicked away in an instant. And that to me is a perfect description of the real. The real is what is, whether you want it or not, what is, whether you're thinking it or not. The concept of the real for me is imminently anti-idealistic, anti-idealist. It's not even an abstract idea of matter. It's an idea of what exists before you think it, and after you stop thinking it, what endures despite you, despite your wishes or your concepts or your beliefs. And it is this that evidently the digital culture gives us an escape from. It's a world where you can undo control Z. I'm sure we've all had that experience in the real world where you suddenly say something you shouldn't have said and you have this instinct to like control Z. I don't get that anymore, but I remember around 2001, 2002, I would constantly get this instinct where, oh, this reflex where I had to undo what I just said or what I'd taken a wrong step. You know, oh, I have to undo that. You know, it's this ability to fully control our experience that is unavailable outside of the digital world. And so I don't think it's about recovering a lost innocence or a lost paradise, but it's about reconnecting with what is actually the case, despite our all too human, you know, aspirations or fantasies or wishes.
So, okay. So bring it back to Stranger Things. Do you think Stranger Things succeeded in, if for just a moment, interrupting, even though it is itself a distraction, it is kind of a, you know, pop open your laptop and watch it on Netflix experience, did it succeed in being able to reach us, the real? Was it able to momentarily pause our distraction through itself being a distraction? Kind of judo move, I guess, with media.
A martial arts reference, I'm not sure a lot of people will get.
I know kung fu. Yes, I think it does, because it's a work of art, and that's the function of art. And works of art are conceived and put together within ideological frameworks, but they bust them. They bust them apart. And they do that if you look at them attentively, and if you believe in them, because of course, like, works of art are also part of the real. Everything you see on the internet is also part of the real. It's the interface that that creates this illusion of control. But if a work of art can be on a digital screen, can be on a canvas, it could be on a napkin, it could be in a conversation. It's just a moment where symbols emerge and point us out of the knowable, out of what we think is fully manageable and knowable about the world, and points us to the mystery. So Stranger Things absolutely connects us to the real. And that's a great thing about digital culture, is that it makes works of art accessible. But it also is challenging in other ways. You know, there's always an instinct when you're, oh, you know, I'll listen to music on the internet. Oh, that's a great song. But already I'm kind of like controlling myself, so I don't try to find another great song halfway through. I have to listen, you know, there's always this sense of control sometimes trumps our capacity to become susceptible, to make ourselves vulnerable to a work of art. But anyways, yes, I do think that Stranger Things succeeds marvelously at connecting us to the real, whether it's consciously or unconsciously.
Well, it takes two to tango, right? Because we could have, and you know, for some episodes, I just watched it in a not very attentive state of mind. It was late at night and I was tired and I wasn't really relating to it as a work of art. I was relating to it as a distraction, as a way of, you know, kind of getting out of the stresses or the rigors of my day. But then what I loved about your essay and just the fact that we are even having this conversation is that you kind of lifted it out of that state of being, you know, that state of being embedded, or that function, you know, where it would just serve to distract me from the real. And by, like, I guess, guiding or constructing like a meditation on it, like you turned it into an object of meditation, basically, you know. And then as you like sit with, as you actually take the time, as you, which I think is essential, like that duration, like as you kind of enter into this analog mode of conscious apprehension of the work of art, that actually lets it be a work of art. But it takes a practice, right? It takes an act of attention, an act of thinking about something, and letting something affect you too, and then noticing what happens. Like when I was watching it earlier today, I was having these intense emotional reactions, and like physical reactions. I was like feeling the fear of you know, Hooper and Joyce as they're going into the upside down, and you know, exploring this dark, you know, what you call it, aqueous, vegetative, you know, type of death realm. I felt the fear, and then I felt the excitement of the kids. Like, it just works on that level because that's what film does. But then at the same time, I'm noticing all these, you know, these more meta perspectives and these Zizekian types of critiques. And, you know, it's all sort of happening simultaneously. But unless we kind of let it be all those things at once, unless we let the real unfold in these multiple dimensions, and give it our time, attention, space, and like mindfulness, then it is just a distraction, I think. I mean, it really has to do with our practice as
I disagree, actually. I don't think that a work of art stops being a work of art because you're not being mindful enough with it. I think works of art have a transformative effect, whether or not you're aware of them. The example here, which is sort of like, you know, an easy example, and I apologize, is Shakespeare. As we all grew up in school learning, at least most of us in a postmodern education, is that Shakespeare was not meant to be a work of art, quote unquote. It was supposed to be, you know, a quote unquote distraction from the grueling life of Elizabethan England. But it also conveyed messages to people while they were being distracted that were incredibly moving and spoke to people's deepest impulses, desires, fears, that sort of thing. Same thing with Greek tragedy. I mean, they had satyr plays in the middle where people were literally just had huge penises and were like faking sexual intercourse. Like, that was a distraction, yes, but there was also something else going on within the greater Greek tragedy that was being shown at that time. That was just to relieve people from the immense like mental and emotional like burdens that they were having to go through by going through this Greek tragedy, which was also a distraction. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we have to like separate it out. Like if I'm mindful, then it's a work of art. If I'm not mindful, it's just a distraction. It can be both at the same time. Like you said, it can be all of these things at once, but I don't think you necessarily have to practice mindfulness to be transformed by a work of art. I think it's just something that happens at a very basic, instinctual, archetypal level. I mean, I'm kind of Jungian in my thinking, so that's probably just my philosophical bias. But that's how I come to art, is that real art transforms you even a little bit, even if you don't want to, even if you're not fully paying attention to it, even if you only look at a work of art just briefly. And I know that, you know, a lot of art denizens will say you need to like pay attention to a painting and really be there with it. But I think there's something that happens to people when there's something that has really touched into reality, has really gotten into the mystery, that even if you breathe, like just are there with it for just a brief moment, even if you just walk by it, something is registering in the back there, something. The mystery in you is reaching out to the mystery there, and it's connecting, even if it's just an unconscious level. And I think that's part of why archetypes are so powerful, is because they don't need to be explained. They're just there and they resonate on this level where you don't need to pay attention. Like you can just enjoy and consume, and something is still happening in you. And then you only realize afterwards, like Marco did at the very end of the series, that he's crying. Like that series did something to him through this process. Even when he was just watching it as what he thought was just a distraction, it wasn't just that moment. It was the whole series of moments that had led up to that point, that whole storytelling that had made him cry at the end. So there's more to it than just a practice of cultivating mindfulness, which I'm not saying isn't, like, mindfulness is absolutely necessary and really like, cultivating an enjoyment of things, but I don't think it's necessarily necessary to really get something out of art.
The real is infectious. Yeah.
Point taken. I think, I think the only thing I would want to reiterate is that particularly with pop culture, although not only with pop culture, because, you know, even the Greek dramas were doing this and even Shakespeare was doing this, is that there is an ideological function. That I think it's it could be dangerous to ignore, you know, because it could be part of the edifice that really keeps the monster monstrous. You know, it's what, you know, makes us pay attention to American Idol or to whatever, you know, was on TV in the 80s and not to Reagan's war in Central America, or, you know, to the actuality of, you know, the embodied experience of the people that are on the other side of, you know, outside this, the screen, outside of the virtual world. So and that's what's so interesting about it. And that's what I think one of the functions of like critique and of interpretation, like which JF has provided in this paper, is to draw out those different dimensions, like that magical dimension where it affects you, even if you're just distracted. I think that's, you know, that's, you know, I wasn't being mindful. The effect it had on me emotionally was not just because I was being mindful. Like, it was because there was something powerful about the art. And, you know, at the same time, like, part of my mind is like, is witnessing this response that I'm having, and is contextualizing it within, you know, what I know about the means in which it was delivered to me and the means in which it was kind of produced in a certain way. You know, it was manufactured in a certain sense. And that's part of what art does. I mean, art uses artifice. It uses this emotional engineering to create effects in us, which is why we subscribe to Netflix and pay them to pay the artists to make the work. So, you know, what I think I'm interested in is like how it really can be authentic, and, you know, how, despite the ideological dimension, it can still be a meaningful experience. And like Jeremy, you were saying earlier, is it just a portal of distraction, or could be a portal that like lets us meet the real?
There's in Zen practice, which I've been sort of doing on and off through my 20s, but I've heard multiple times, and I can sort of express my own experience with it, where, you know, there are times where you're sitting and meditating and you're not really doing it well, and you're not really focused, and you're not really in a state of any kind of deep concentration. And yet after the session, you still feel the effects of it. It's still done something to you. So I think there's something to this idea that even kind of just being with something, even if you're just sitting on a zafu zaputan, it's still doing something to you. Even if you're watching a film, it's still doing something to you. And there's multiple layers and levels of what it's doing, from, you know, Zizek's political ideology that a film might be sort of implicating in an unconscious way, to even an encounter with the real and the uncanny. And they can both be happening at the same time in different aspects of the same film. So it's an interesting question to sort of explore that. But I guess as sort of like a final thing, because we're coming up on, I think we're right around a little over an hour now. I don't want us to go too much over that. But as sort of a capstone to this question, I wanted to just go right back to the beginning and ask, what do we identify? What do we consider? How do we understand the word strange and stranger? Because to me, all of this links back to the uncanny, to the sort of unknowable quality of this real, the real, right? And I've been reading Tim Morton, who's a Rice English professor who's written a few books about hyperobjects and dark ecologies and all fun stuff that I won't get into here. But one of the things he often mentions is how, you know, when we encounter the world is this strange loop of civilization and the tools of civilization and being a cultured being with language and everything else. And then suddenly meeting nature in its strange otherness and waking up to a world, especially right now with ecological crisis, waking up to a world populated by strange others. So this idea of the weird and the strange, Eric Davis uses this concept from the 1970s period, the high weirdness of the 70s and the literary movements then. So strangeness and weirdness as words are really interesting, and they seem to be coming up a lot. So JF, you mentioned strange, and you kind of go into it, unpack it in your essay a little bit. I was wondering if you could unpack it for our listeners now. What is strange? What exactly does that mean?
So I start the essay by dealing with that word, strange. And my thinking was that there are two ways that something can be strange. Something can be strange in effect, or something can be strange in fact. So, and I call these, the first type of strangeness would be epistemological, because it has to do with how we see things, how we experience the world. It's a subjective strangeness. It's a subjective sense of something being strange. And then there's ontological strangeness, which is something that turns out to be strange, absolutely strange in an absolute sense, in the sense that reason can't explain it. So if something can be strange until I get more information in order to fit it into my rational kind of framework, or something can defy reason altogether and be strange to the degree that it becomes something else. It becomes what we call in literature weird. And the weird is what absolutely defies reason. And even if there's just one thing in the universe that absolutely defies reason, then the universe is fundamentally capable of producing something that defies reason, you know, something that is absolutely weird. So if reality is absolutely weird, or potentially absolutely weird, then we as humans are in no place to decide on what this universe is capable of. It is literally, logically capable of anything, even the most illogical transformation. So this is something I'm kind of riffing off of a French philosopher named Quentin Meillassou, who I really recommend. He wrote a book called After Finitude, but he's using this theory to defend a hyper-materialist scientistic kind of paradigm. But I see it as the ultimate kind of door out of the closed human world that we tend to want to construct around us. So if we live in an absolutely weird world, then any work of art that portrays the world as absolutely weird is a realistic work of art. So the weirder a work of art is, the weirder reality turns out to be in a work of art, the more realistic it is in terms of aligning itself with reality. So that's kind of one of the veins in the essay, you know? And so yeah, that's my riff on strangeness. I don't know if you guys want to comment on that.
I mean, I thought that was very well put. I agree with you entirely. I don't know, Marco, did you have any notes on strangeness?
No. Maybe it's strange that I don't.
Do you want some time to think about it?
I don't know. I think that's brilliant. I mean, I think I'm very attracted to the weird. You know, it's almost like a fetish.
In the original sense of the word, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much what a fetish is.
But that may just be Zizek's infection, you know, slipping back in again, which I did not at all intend before this talk began. It just kind of came through.
Just knowing you as a person, you often look through the lens of Zizek and that sort of thing. So I'm not surprised that you analyzed it that way as well, because you've looked at even the project of metapsychosis through that lens as well. So, but that's interesting, because I wouldn't have considered it before. Jeremy, do you want to talk about how you experience strangeness and what you think of strangeness?
Sure. I mean, beyond what was already said and what you said, JF, about this kind of, you know, if the universe is, even if one hour on one planet of the entire universe was capable of something that defied all physics and everything we understand and know, then yeah, then we don't truly know anything about anything. And we're kind of just living in our own constructed ideological, human nests, like an ant would build a nest and try to interface with the world that it doesn't completely comprehend. So very Lovecraftian, I guess, to kind of put it that way. But yeah, I've always been attracted to it as well. And I think to kind of tie it back to sort of the 80s life world and why there's such a, perhaps this is why there's such a draw for Spielbergian strangeness crawling out of things that seem to be normal. There's this desire to encounter the real and resist our own tendencies to try to create a life world that's controllable and boring and predictable and knowable. It's always there on the borderlands. It's always there in the forest. And now there's new archetypes for it in terms of, you know, the research facility, the psychic test patient, the monster from another dimension, whatever form it takes. It's always kind of shape-shifting. And I guess, you know, in the past, this is another thing Morton mentions too about the weird and the weirding and the fairy and how they have some kind of etymological link. The Borderlands, and Natalie wrote a whole essay about the fairy and the Borderlands. So there's something satisfying, and not in a controlling way, but in a kind of opening way, in a kind of sublimating way, about the strange, about the things that we can't control and explain. And it's something to do with even ourselves. So I like any story that kind of even makes the suburbs look strange, makes the modern world look strange, and ultimately kind of makes ourselves as human beings unknowable, and makes us confront that unknowability of even who we are. It's kind of a, yeah.
I just want to, it doesn't, like, to me, it doesn't, when I say that the weirdest works of art are the most realistic, I don't necessarily mean that they need to be genre works of art or speculative even. I mean, the Chirico, you know, painter, like he finds commonplace items and aligns them in such a way that they become weird. Diane Arbus, photographer, found the weird in the most banal settings or environments. So like, it's not a question of using ideas from folklore and reviving them, or, you know, necessarily. In fact, sometimes genre can reaffirm and can kind of consolidate an anti-realist perspective from this point of view, but sometimes it doesn't. So there's no lines. It's not like either or, but yeah, the weird can take on, can occur in the most mundane places. I mean, any instance of synchronicity points us to the weird. How could that have happened when I was thinking this, or how can that have happened in this context? There's no way to tally up the odds of that happening, and yet it happens all the time, you know? So it's that's what I was getting at.
I think I almost get a kind of, I don't want to go as far as to say sadistic, but I do get a certain pleasure out of seeing people that don't like to be confronted with weird things, or find or try to keep their lives as not weird as possible. And then something happens to them that is absolutely unexplainable or uncanny. And you talk to them and they're like, I have no idea what that was. And then you just see like their whole like sense of reality is like being churned around in their head, trying to like fit it into what they had thought before. Even with something as simple as, you know, someone who doesn't believe in ghosts seeing a ghost, and you, and like, sure, okay, maybe I imagined it, but even then they have to be confronted with their mind being able to make something so real. That in itself is incredible, that you can, that the mind can project something that you feel and experience is so real. And I am like a folklorist, so I do think of Stranger Things through a folklore perspective, and I am planning on writing an essay about that a little bit later, about how the Upside Down is sort of the way that we used to think about fairy and changelings and that sort of thing. I mean, Eleven is definitely in some ways a changeling, and there's even changeling themes going on in with the, you know, swapped body and everything that's fake. But Jeremy and I think one of the reasons we get along so well is because we go out searching for weird things. Like, we will make a point to try and find as much weird as weird stuff as possible. And if we are not finding it, we'll try to create it. Like, even just by talking about weird things. And then what's the weirdest part of that weird thing is that the more you start thinking about weirdness, the more it seems to pop up in your world. And that is something I really noted when I was in Indiana, which is interesting. You're tying that back to the beginning. When I was in Indiana, the most banal place you'd think to live in, the more I went searching for strange places, strange people, strange occurrences, there just seemed to be a flood of them. How can all this weirdness be in one place, just in like this, you know, 40 square mile radius that I was living in? How can so much weirdness be in one place? And then you start to realize it's everywhere. It's just, I don't know. I don't want to be as, you know, crude to say as like whether or not you're tuned into it, but there's something about it when you realize that that's actually what reality is, it wants to reveal itself to you. And I think that is part of what goes back to this idea of fairy, is that nature wants to reveal how strange it is to you. And that used to be something that our ancestors confronted on a daily basis with nature, was they would actually see these things in nature frequently. These weren't just like folk tales. These were actual encounters people had with these strange projections of nature. And the less we believe in them, the less they seem to be there. So anyways, I'll be writing an essay about this later, but that's how I think of strangeness, is the fairy and this kind of weirdness that's imminent in nature. And when we ignore it, it leaves us alone for the most part, but there's always just like, it will come out eventually. If the more you try to run from it, eventually it'll pop out, and you'll be more scared of it for trying to have rejected it as long as you did. And yeah. So
what do you make of the connection between the natural, like, and particularly in the show? I mean, the weird, the Upside Down is really portrayed in a feminine dimension. Like, you have to go through these sort of,
yeah, you basically have to go through, like, I was noticing that as well, through like the female reproductive organs, like in the tree, like it looked like that and there was no way of getting around it. And I think, you know, I'm planning on having another podcast with more of a feminist thinker about Stranger Things, which I think is also going to be included in Metapsychosis. So we'll get more into those themes in that podcast. But I do think that there, like we were talking about earlier, there is this feminine rejection of nature and the weird. They all kind of go together, and it comes out within in a really violent way. But it's only the girl that can really mediate these things, that can really have any kind of control over what's going on. And even she's trying to be controlled by this, you know, patriarchal figure. It's very interesting, but that's for another talk, I think. So tune in for that podcast. That'll be coming up.
JF, you got something at the tip of your tongue?
I just wanted to say that one of the weirdest experiences of my life was the birth of my daughter on my couch in Toronto, which wasn't, we didn't intend a home birth, but it just happened that way. And it was very weird. And it reminded me, I don't want to get into a big thing, but it reminded me of this book, this French Canadian book. It's a classic in Quebec. It's called Agaguk. And it's a story about an Inuit hunter. And there's it's very racist, colonialist. It's written by a white guy who tries to pass himself off as a native. And, but it's like still a good novel in some ways. There's a moment where he's watching his wife give birth in the igloo, and he gets so disturbed by it that he beats her, which is, and I remember the scene being so shocking when I read it. And of course, there's no connection to how the Inuit actually function or live their lives. But this was all about this author and his problems. But at the same time, there's this thing about watching a human come out of another human. It's you know, when you just break it down like that, it's very strange. And you know, women physiologically have these, are connected on a certain level. And men are, it's easier for men to fly off into the intellect, maybe, or into ideas about things. And maybe that in itself is kind of a misogynistic thought. I don't know, but it was my experience. It's
hard I kind of get what you're saying. There's this concept in feminist psychology called womb envy, which is like kind of the reverse of penis envy. And it's the idea that men are jealous of women's inherent capacity, creativity to create life inside their bodies. They're jealous of it, and so they seek to control women because they find this huge creative capacity within the woman's body to be threatening and you know, and profoundly spiritual, to a sense that it's like it is like confronts you on a very deep emotional and human level. So that's, I don't really believe in either of those envies so much, but I can kind of see how men who aren't as connected with women or with their feminine side so much would be, I can see how someone would be shocked and horrified enough by a woman's creative capacity to want to beat her into like, to feel more in power again, feel like he's more in power. And in a way, that's sort of what's happening to Eleven with her mentor. He's basically, he sees how powerful she is, but he wants that power for himself. He doesn't want her to self-actualize. He wants to control that power for his own aims, and he's willing to abuse her in order to do it. So there's a lot of feminist themes that definitely come into play here, which we're like going right into the next podcast that we're going to, and if any of you would like to participate in it, you're welcome to. It was just the two of us, me and Greenfire right now, but it'd be cool if it was a bigger discussion. And I do think that men belong in feminist discussions. So
that's it for this episode. If you'd like to listen again, just turn the tape over. Electric Symposium is a project of Theory of Everybody, a platform for social poetics and planetary thought. In addition to this podcast network, Theory of Everybody currently hosts projects like Metapsychosis Journal, Lit Geeks, an unusually hardcore book club, and a discussion platform that ties it all together, infiniteconversations.com. You can learn more and support our work at theoryofeverybody.com.